You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday,
July 8th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I am Michael Brooks,
and this is
the award-winning.
Oh man, I'm bad.
Majority Report.
The Majority Report. Yes, three.
Go ahead.
We are broadcasting, and levels are off and everything. We are broadcasting to you live from the literal, but not metaphor. From the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City.
Oof.
Matt and Michael Monday off to a patchy start after a long vacation. But very happy to be back with you all. Today joining us, Steve Horn, an investigative reporter for the Smog Blog, talking about Exxon, Keystone XL Pipeline, and how to really finally get an actual climate policy, climate movement, climate response that we need. That Egypt boiling over after a military coup that I predicted on this program may not be such a hot idea commenced a couple days ago. Elliot Spitzer's back. What else do we got?
I like how you gave yourself the props for...
I had to.
But I mean, like... Is that really a stretch, though? Like, did you really take it that far? Coup, not such a great idea. Called it. I mean, come on now.
This has gone worse than even I predicted with my skepticism. But fair point.
Okay.
What else we got, man?
We got a ton. So much, you freebies probably ain't getting it all. I mean, not even probably, are definitely.
Yeah, you freebies are not going to get a lot of this.
I mean, We have a story about a Louisiana Republican who would like to ban the LGBT rainbow flag from public buildings. The reason is hilarious. We also have a shocking story of a police officer who beat a kid and then was just not found. He was charged, shockingly, but not found guilty because the judge just didn't want to see the video evidence.
So ridiculous.
Yeah. What else you got?
We got David Gregory being ridiculous.
Oh, we have a Snowden update.
We have Snowden updates.
For those who are laughing at us, for those anti-Snowden Glenn Greenwald bashers who thought it was hilarious that, you know, all these countries were turning down Snowden's asylum request.
A couple have come through, and
probably
some of it had something to do with ordering an international stop and frisk on the president of Bolivia's plane. Not such a great way to win friends and influence people. I'll say this. The Obama administration, not so clear on how to handle Egypt, but very clear on stopping Evo Morales' plane to get Edward Snowden. Not very impressive. Let's see. And Elliot Spitzer back, running for comptroller in New York City. The economic recovery is coming on the backs of low-wage workers. So the next time you go into a fast food joint and you see someone who's being relentlessly abused by McDonald's or KFC or Burger King, thank them. They're a pretty prime cause of what I guess are theoretically good jobs numbers. I don't know how good they actually are. But anyways, we got a lot of stuff to get to. We're going to take a quick break, come right back with Steve Horn, and talk climate change. We'll be right back, folks.
I forgot to pull our famous Matt and Mike playlist.
Ugh. I guess so. Sorry. Standard theme.
Oh, well.
Sorry, folks. Welcome back, Michael Brooks, joined as always, obviously, by the great Matt Binder. This is the Majority Report. Joining us now is Steve Horn. He's a research fellow at the Smog Blog and a investigative reporter. Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. So you have a new piece out in the Smog Blog on two major lawsuits that have been filed against ExxonMobil related to the Arkansas tar sands spill. This is a really interesting story. It's not getting much attention, but these are really significant lawsuits from environmental and public health perspective. And Exxon is obviously a tremendously powerful and pretty deeply unaccountable company. So what's going on here? What are behind these lawsuits, and what are the specifics of them? What are they about?
Sure. So there's two specific lawsuits that were filed, both basically around the same time. One of them was a class action tort lawsuit for various damages that were suffered by what's known as the Lake Conway class in Mayflower, Arkansas. It's a class of people who lives close to Lake Conway, which is one of the largest man-made lakes in the state of Arkansas. It was created by the Gaming and Fish Commission, and lots of tar sands spilled into and around that lake and into people's backyards, front yards, down the streets of Mayflower, Arkansas, which is a small town kind of about 30 minutes away from the capital of Arkansas. And basically what happened in this suit is that they're being everything that Exxon did that could have been done to prevent this spill was not done. So this is what the suit is about. So, for example, one of the main tenets of the suit is that the piping that they were using was from the 1940s, and the pipeline itself, the Pegasus pipeline, was built for conventional crude, not tar sands crude. It was originally a pipe that flowed the opposite way as it flows now. So it flowed from the Gulf Coast upwards towards the Midwest. Now it flows from the Midwest in Patoka, Illinois, down to Nederlands, Texas, to Gulf Coast refineries where it's sent to the export market. And this pipeline wasn't built at all for tar sands. Exxon knew it wasn't built for tar sands, and that's basically what the suit says, is Exxon had chances to do something otherwise. Even had deals set up with Enbridge, joint venture partnerships with Enbridge, for example, that they turned down because it was cheaper for them to keep this pipeline infrastructure in place. And they made a corporate business decision basically to say, okay, this is what we have. This would be cheaper for us just to keep rather than investing money in a new pipeline that may have prevented this spill. What happened to this pipeline itself was that there was something seriously wrong with it in that a 22-foot gash happened in the pipeline, and that's why it exploded in Mayflower. And the people in Mayflower itself are definitely suffering because of this pipeline, as the case points out. And there's been air studies, for example, that this lawsuit cites that say that there are tons of toxic chemicals in the air that include benzene, toluene, ethyl benzene, xylenes, tons of other chemicals that are just really hazardous to breathe in. And that kind of segues into the second suit, and that's the EPA, Arkansas Attorney General lawsuit, which the EPA says that Exxon committed a violation of the Clean Water Act. And then the Arkansas Attorney General's office says that Exxon committed violations of both the Arkansas Waste Management Act and the Arkansas Water and Pollution Control Act. On the whole, if you couple these cases together, damages could be up to, that Exxon would have to pay, are up to $125 million, depending on how the suits play out. And I'm kind of skeptical that Exxon will lose these cases. They may settle for an amount lesser than that, but it is really important, the timing of it all, because of the – oh, go ahead.
No, I was just curious. Two brief addendums. So the number you just cite, would that include punitive damages or just basically damages that Exxon's going to need to pay to, you know, make up for the spills?
That's a combination number that I came up with.
Okay.
For the damages under both suits. So one of them was, to be more specific, damages up to $5 million as a class suffered by the what's called the Lake Conway class, plus as individuals up to $75,000 each. Anything that goes up to that, they would be due to pay under that lawsuit. The other lawsuit is actually more minor in scope in terms of, this is a very basic lawsuit in terms of what it could amount to being. And what they would have to pay is, I tallied the number, and it's, at minimum, the range of what they'd pay for that suit is only 0.008 of its 2012 profit, and at most up to a third of a percent of their profit.
So this is almost really analogous in some ways to, or directly analogous, I would say, to a pharmaceutical company doing a kind of internal assessment and just releasing a drug they know is unsafe on the market, and calculating any possible financial backlash into the profits, which will be pretty minimal, or for that matter, HSBC laundering money for drug cartels and terrorists and knowing that they'll pay a nominal fine and it won't cut into their profit margins with it. Now,
I think you
an interesting connection between this.
I want to add one thing
there
and just say that this is the norm. These decisions are made all the time by the industry, and because fines are so minimal, especially if you look at what they'll have to pay for the EPA, Arkansas Attorney General lawsuit combined, they just write it off very specifically as a cost of doing business. And until the fines are made way bigger and way stronger and the penalties are stronger in nature in general, these are going to continue, and there's no reason for Exxon not to keep doing what it's doing.
Now, really briefly, I want to transition this into, you drew a very disturbing connection between this case and the Keystone Pipeline, obviously, which we'll get to in a moment. But you did say you don't think it's likely that, even given how insufficient these fines and penalties would be to begin with, you don't think Exxon's likely to lose these cases anyways. Why do you think that is?
Based on things in the past that Exxon's gotten away with that are highlighted extensively in Steve Kahl's book, Private Empire, which I kind of pointed to indirectly in the article. They got away basically with hardly any penalties for the Valdez spill in Alaska. you know, for instance, they got away with implementing running the no-fly zone above Mayflower on behalf of the Federal Aviation Administration. So, you know, as Inside Climate News has described it, on the whole, they've run the show in Mayflower, and it seems just unlikely to me that the government is going to stand up to ExxonMobil because of how much power they have and, you know, how much influence they have in terms of funding campaigns and all sorts of things that just lead me to believe that it's not likely that anything will happen other than a settlement. But we'll see how it plays out.
But yet the Obama EPA did choose to take on this case. Is there anything
kind
of optimistic to be read from that? Yeah.
Yeah, I found that very significant. It's not – again, the problem is what I said is not that the EPA took on the case. It's that the penalties that the EPA doles out for these violations are just way too low for Exxon to care much about actually changing its behavior in the long term because the fines are so low. Again, it's just the cost of doing business. But it still is significant that the EPA took it on, and I think it's – because there's lots of other things going on with tar sands, and it would look very bad if they just turned a blind eye to it because of the health impacts that are happening to people there right now and all the toxic chemicals that are in the air. If they didn't apply the Clean Air Act to this spill, it would just look horrific.
Right. So let's get to those other implications. What does this tell us about another reason to add to this, seems like the endless list of why we should be incredibly worried about constructing the Keystone XL pipeline?
Sure. So, I mean, like the Exxon pipeline, the Pegasus pipeline that we're talking about here, Keystone XL is a bigger pipeline. It's a 36-inch pipeline. I guess that's not like Exxon, whereas that one's 20 inches. But like it, it's for the export market, in which high capacities of tar sands are going to be passing through the pipe. It will be a newer piping, but as I pointed to in the piece, that doesn't mean that it's foolproof or anything. There's already signs that the southern half, the Keystone XL, the welding has anomalies and dents and such, as Public Citizen discovered, and they're already doing – Michaels Corporation, the contractor for TransCanada, is already – had to go down there and do some repair work for the pipeline before it's actually online. Then the tar sands blockade members, actually, who got inside the pipeline, went in and saw that there's actually cracks in the welding and could see light through the pipe. So
right from the inception,
right now, inadequate. Oh, go ahead.
No. Sorry, I'm just saying that right from the beginning, this isn't in the Keystone case. This is not a case of repairs breaking down, you know, or Exxon choosing not to make upgrades, or in this case, TransCanada. This is right from the very beginning, you know, faulty design, almost in the same way, maybe again to draw another analogy, a nuclear reactor, you know, being brought online without proper safety measures right from the get-go.
Yeah, and I just want, you know, the there's already these problems, and then there's the overarching problem of the fact that the environmental impact statement that the State Department did was contracted out to an API, American Petroleum Institute, dues-paying member, the Environmental Resource Management Group, or ERM group, and they have a history of greenlighting pipeline projects, such as one in the Caspian Sea area called the Baku-Tehan, Tibisili pipeline, or the BTC pipeline, another one in Peru, the Peru LNG project. Both of those pipeline projects have been disastrous in those countries, and ERM Group was a contractor chosen in those countries to say that the pipeline was safe. So I see lots of problems in terms of what this portends for the Keystone XL, especially above and beyond just we're talking about now, the Pegasus pipeline. There's been all types of pipeline spills, and they happen almost weekly. It's hard to keep up with how many there are. So it comes down to a problem of, I don't know if any infrastructure, especially when it's being built on the cheap and there's hardly any penalties for building it on the cheap and you know, damaging ecosystem and people, when those two factors are considered, this portends a lot of future damages that TransCanada Keystone XL could bring to people along the route. And then overall, just the climate change problems, too, of extracting huge amounts of tar sands, one of the dirtiest fuels on the planet, for an export, for the global export market. So there's lots of things
right.
here
oh,
that
oh, just those
talk
too,
about.
Yeah. so, no, it's fascinating because it almost seems to me when we talk about, you know, the regularity of these spills and these pipelines and the kind of just, and then we get into fracking and other areas that you cover really well, the public health and environmental consequences that are occurring on an almost daily basis across America. And then you kind of think of a parallel economy of people working at subsistent wages at places like Walmart or off of the books. You really have this whole right below the radar infrastructure of America that's operating in a completely extractive and exploitative economic framework that barely kind of punctures the sort of broad media or political bubble around Washington and New York. It's really kind of shocking. So I do want to get into this other component of the climate change piece. Now, President Obama, I know people will probably accuse me. I still attempt, and I like to find positive parts of his record. I watched this speech. I didn't quite understand what he was saying about Keystone, and I've heard people interpret what he said really positively, and I've heard other people interpret it really negatively, which, you know, that seems very – that's highly Obama. You know, he's almost like, look, if I wink on the third section of the speech, then that's an indication that I'm concerned about what you're saying, but I might contradict myself in the next paragraph. Sorry, that was a bit of an Obama impression there. But at any rate, I want to get from you first specifically your take on what he said on Keystone, because I do think that that sort of seems to be like the exemplary climate issue of the moment. And then more
sure.
broadly, what are the pros and cons of what he's doing on climate and what he's saying about doing on climate?
Sure. Keystone is – it really depends on your context about what he said, because to me, I took it as which is a lot different than what other people took it as. I took it as an endorsement of the Keystone XL pipeline, and I wrote an article wow. about this because of what I cited before, that his State Department's environmental impact statement that was done by that API dues-paying member, ERM group, has already come out and said there are not significant climate change impacts of the Keystone XL pipeline. Due to that, in Obama's speech, he said that the pipeline will not be in the national interest if there are net carbon impacts, I think is what he said, of the pipeline.
Yeah.
Put two and two together, and to me that means under his State Department's, a.k.a. API's, environmental impact statement for the Keystone XL, the pipeline will be approved unless people come out and challenge that study more, because that's an official governmental document that he will cite when he goes ahead with either approving or not approving the pipeline. So for me, it was an approval. Unless this study can be delegitimized, it's game on for the Keystone XL pipeline's northern half. I mean, in the southern, I want to be clear, the southern half was already approved by the
right.
Obama administration
right.
via a March 2012 executive order. So when we talk about the Keystone XL pipeline now, we're just talking about the northern half that goes from Alberta and crosses the Canadian-U.S. border down to Cushing, Oklahoma, because the Cushing extension is already over 80% built.
Yeah, and I think – and President Obama actually campaigned on construction sites along that route and bragged about it. So, you know,
exactly.
obviously
yeah.
that's important.
Yeah, he
context.
Made a campaign speech the day after that executive order was – issued, and he did make it in front of, kind of embarrassingly in my opinion, in front of the actual pipes that will consist of the southern extension of the pipeline in Cushing, which is known by the industry as the pipeline crossroads of the world.
Okay. So, and I actually remember vividly, I remember watching that speech, and he said, he used a line he used a lot during the campaign, as he said, you know, he was making that we can't just drill our way out of this point and we'll have an all of the above approach. And he said, but, you know, the other side, they would just, you know, they would be trying to, you know, tap for oil in the lawn of the White House or the lawn of anybody's house. And I remember I looked at Fox Business and Stuart Varney had a guest on, and he said, you can drill in my yard if you like. And that was, and she's like, and then I forget the woman's name. She went, heck yeah, if you pay me. So, but that's a way of transitioning actually into the other part that I want you to highlight in Obama's speech that is probably the other really salient and deep criticism, which is the, even if you're watching it like me, and that's great context on Keystone, I thought he said a lot of good things about the seriousness of climate, about pushing for renewables, but even in my less trained eye, I saw a huge cheerleading for natural gas and fracking. Am I right to see that? And what's that about?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You're right on the money on everything you just said. I don't want to discount that it's important to talk about climate change because it is. It's a global catastrophe in the making. But I do want to go on the record saying that the speech was a cheerleading of fracking, even though he never used the word fracking in either the speech or the accompanying climate action plan, which is the 20-page document that he was speaking about. And in saying that it was, he said, clean burning natural gas, what he was doing in the climate plan itself was endorsing basically what he's already endorsed, both in his first term and into what he campaigned on. And that's an endorsement of every aspect of the shale gas market. That's, it starts with the frack sand itself, where the sand is mined here, actually where I live in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. That sand is used to do the fracking. So he endorsed fracking, even though he never used the term. But then he went above and beyond that in the Climate Action Plan and also endorsed actually the T. Boone Pickens plan, which is tax credits for 18-wheelers, natural gas vehicles, but mostly for big trucks. And then above and beyond that, he also endorsed shale gas exports, so creating an export market for the fracked gas here in the United States, mostly in the Gulf Coast terminals. And then also endorsed in the Climate Action Plan one more important thing, and that's using the United States State Department as basically a missionary force to teach other countries how to do fracking, and that's through what was created in his first term, the Global Shale Gas Initiative. Which
all right, you've convinced me, Steve. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Keep going. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. It also goes by the name now the Unconventional Gas Engagement Program. So all of these things were either endorsed in his speech or endorsed in the plan itself that he was talking about in the speech, and that's above and beyond everything else, if this is fully realized, is both an ecological hazard because of all the, the water and air impacts of fracking at frack sites, but also the climate impacts of fracking are just disastrous. Life cycle studies have shown that it's actually probably dirtier than coal, as shown in a study by Cornell University's Bob Howarth and Tony Ingraffia in May 2011, and there's been many other studies that have linked fracking to water contamination. And all you need is everyday people's testimonies of how their water is contaminated. But, I think it's really important to acknowledge that this is a huge problem in the Climate Action Plan and not something that anyone who has any interest in climate action being taken can endorse, in my opinion.
So I just want to really highlight that. That's fascinating because I'm very familiar with the debate on the ecological impacts of fracking, and I'm convinced, I don't really have a doubt that that's bad for local water and ecology. But there still seems to be this kind of there's less of a public debate about the notion that, well, natural gas is kind of, the term bridge fuel is used a lot. It's not as dirty as other conventional fuels. So, in the same sort of pragmatic perspective, we do need to sort of think about that in a climate context. And you're saying that's almost analogous to talking about like clean coal. That's a scientific misnomer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. It really is. And the whole bridge fuel concept, not just scientists have written about it, but a guy like Joe Rahm writes a lot about it too. How it's not a bridge fuel to anything, but a bridge to nowhere, and that's a bridge to climate catastrophe. And and I also want to, because you talked about coal, you broached the topic, I want to say that the speech was actually more of an endorsement of coal than people may have realized, and that's because of what's going on domestically with the coal industry and globally with the coal industry. The United States is increasingly not a coal, it doesn't emit, it doesn't produce coal as much in the power plants, it doesn't use it anymore, it's using natural gas because of the fracking boom, and coal is still going to be produced under the Climate Action Plan, and it's going to be exported to the global market as it already is in the Powder River Basin, especially in the Northwest.
Right.
And you know, that globally, you know, climate change is a global problem that's very troubling. And, you know, although he did talk about, you know, natural gas, clean burning natural gas power plants, there's still going to be coal power plants that are being built around the world under the plan. It was just kind of a, you know, there's an error by omission. By not talking about it doesn't mean that it's not there, but it is there. And a lot of people in the Northwest are fighting back against it, but it wasn't really that the whole coal exports wasn't addressed in the speech, and I think that was definitely for a reason. I think it was to kind of greenwash what's actually happening in the United States.
And even to the extent to which there are maybe genuine positive steps on other technologies and other policy moves in the context of this speech, I think you're, you know, nailing something else that's really important right there, which is that fundamentally, obviously, climate and global warming are global issues. So even a strategy that weans one country off of something like coal that still has an export base built around it is obviously not going to be fundamentally solving the problem. But at any rate, Steve, it's been excellent talking with you. I feel like this has given it's a little discouraging on the Obama speech front, but it sounds right to me. And that's really interesting, too, that basically that he's setting the stage for validating a decision based off of a study that's been outsourced to just sort of a greenwashing stamp consulting firm, essentially. So that's interesting.
Yep.
All right. Well, great. Look, everybody should check out Steve's work at the Smog blog. I think that, you know, if you want to understand any of this stuff, climate, fracking, corporate control of the policymaking process, you got to look at Steve's work. It was great having you on, Steve, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, pleasure. Take care. Well, I don't know what to say, man. Obama's global warming policy not looking very good there.
Can we get a little bit of Obama, please?
Look. With regards to coal, what I've said is that if you see me, give a signal. The third page, the third paragraph of a speech. That means we're going to move off of coal 30 years from now. I've said I don't like coal. I don't know what more people want from me. I think that's a problem with Obama in some ways. It's almost like he thinks after he's made a speech that the work is done or something. It's like an interesting approach to governing. It's like, whoa, if Obama's given a speech about your issue, look out. And it sounds really good. That might mean you're in a really dangerous situation.
Look, we deal with climate change. Here's how we're going to do it. Construct the Keystone XL pipeline and export coal to China. Look,
I don't know. I mean, I think that there were aspects of that speech that were positive, and he has done some really great things on wind and solar and other areas, but there's no question, just even on the fracking thing alone. And it's like, I know a friend of mine's brother worked as like a laborer in Idaho in one of these like fracking boom towns. And I get, you know, he's making money and getting access to a livelihood that he would not have in a lot of other, you know, situations. You know, he was laid off out of the construction industry after the housing boom. But I think the whole attitude around fracking is essentially it's almost like the energy equivalent of a housing boom. I have no doubt that the amount of resources that people say are there are exaggerated, and it's going to be a big bonanza, and it's going to hurt the environment, and it's going to employ some people in the short term. And obviously, we're in a situation where it's like, my God, you can't dismiss the importance of that, because the employment is such a horrible situation in this country. But fundamentally, it's just another incredibly short-sighted, it's a gold rush, basically. And to see, and maybe this is being really nasty, but I think in some respects, especially if you took the view that natural gas really was distinctly not near as good as renewables, obviously, but distinctly better than maybe gas and coal, I would say it is the energy equivalent of Barack Obama, which is that it's better than the alternatives. The alternatives are really not so good,
good,
and we need to move out of it. But anyways.
Well done, Michael Brooks.
I don't know. It was either well done or totally ridiculous. I hear Bill Scheer just spinning right now, just like, ah, how dare you? I think a lot of people like us want Obama to be a really good president, want him to succeed. But, you know, what can you do? I'm all for, I want to give him as much credit as possible for all the things that he's done well. But at a certain point, like, my God.
For me, it's more so like the crap he gets flung at him with these
absolutely
fake right-wing Fox News,
absolutely,
you know, Rush Limbaugh type stories. And that's actually like, that's, I mean, I disagree with him on so much, but at the same time, what they fling at him is just makes you want to root for the guy to do something
good. I agree with you
100%.
I think that the amount of, there is this part of him where this sort of, you know, I would say in a lot of ways, basically competent, decent guy who's tried to move the ball forward in some respects has been the victim of the most disgusting, racist, conspiratorial, vitriolic, insane, all of the worst aspects of American society are channeled at this guy every day, every second. Media, corporate sector. I mean, even Wall Street guys were having, you know, mental breakdowns because Obama, who bailed them out and, you know, was unbelievably easy on them, just because he might occasionally use a phrase like fat cats, or just even because it's clear that Obama doesn't think necessarily that they're the most brilliant people on earth all the time. That was enough for them to have, you know, complete emotional meltdowns. And then you look at, and like you're just saying, look at Fox, you look at Rush. What he gets targeted at, and God only knows the types of death threats and other absolutely heinous things that come in his family from supremacist groups and racists. I agree. There is that part where you just want to, it's like, no, if that's the choice, I'm definitely on this guy's side. He is the voice of reason and sanity and openness and tolerance and compassion and opportunity. But then at the same time, you got to look at the whole record, and it's just, it's wanting. I mean, I don't know how you can even make that debate at this point. I don't know how you can. I get people making the argument that he's done the best of what he has. Some people out there trying to make the argument that this is this really fundamentally transformative presidency on this broad policy level. I just don't see how he could do it. I don't see it.
I mean, you could like the guy for the reasons I said.
Absolutely.
But still fully admit he's failed in those aspects.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that, and there's some areas where it's not his fault that he's failed, and it's some areas where it's absolutely his and his administration's fault and responsibility. But anyway, let's get to someone that we don't feel ambivalent about. We just sort of don't like. David Gregory. So David Gregory, as we all know, spends a lot of his time doing Tim Russert's job worse than Tim Russert, which maybe Tim Russert didn't do so well either. And also really worrying about whether or not Glenn Greenwald should be going to jail, which is a really burning question on the national mind, everywhere outside of Washington.
Especially D.C. A great question to pose to the journalist in question himself.
Absolutely.
Great reporting there.
Stellar work. As Anthony Weiner would say, aces, David Gregory. So anyways, David Gregory, who, as we all know, is a lot of time that he needs to put into
wondering if other journalists should go to jail, looking over talking points that he's been emailed from the Republican National Committee, trying to get make sure that John McCain is available and Lindsey Graham are available on block for the next year, since they're on his show every Sunday, to say the same things constantly. So it's understandable why David Gregory, even he, that sharp sleuth of a journalist, might not know every aspect of healthcare reform, which is, as we all know, is coming into implementation now. And he might get a few of the facts wrong. So let's play this clip.
Gene Robinson, I don't understand exactly how the exchanges are going to work. Uh-huh. I don't understand all the ins and outs of the employer mandate and how that works. But
I just have to say, if you start out with that, then maybe, just maybe, you should move on to something else.
And I will just add, very honest analysis so far from David Gregory. I don't understand how the exchanges work. I don't understand how the employee mandate is going to work. I don't know what healthcare is. Fundamentally,
this is the best journalistic work David Gregory has done so far.
Very transparent of David Gregory so far. Let's keep going.
Anybody who gets a paycheck in this country understands one thing, yeah, that there's a new line item, and it says Medicare surtax. So the tax part's working.
Yeah,
you're paying more in taxes for Obamacare. That part's working. It makes a lot of people mad.
Oh, that does sound really bad.
Makes a lot of people mad.
Makes a lot of people mad because all these other things that David Gregory totally doesn't understand are not happening yet. But the tax part is happening, and David Gregory certainly understands that.
David Gregory is on it.
David Gregory is on it. But, you know, I don't know what else to say. David Gregory is wrong, and I think what should go with that would probably be one of these.
Wow!
Yeah. So David Gregory is saying that there's going to be a surtax that everybody is going to need to pay now. It's going to be a line item on their tax forms, essentially, that says that's like the new Medicare surtax. Okay. So let's just get straight to it right here. According to the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, this tax that Gregory is talking about will only apply to individuals with an annual income of above $200,000 a year. Now, there's two scenarios here to understand why David Gregory is wrong. The first, which we've been kind of riffing on, which is that he doesn't really know anything about policy and is too busy worried about, hopefully throwing a blindfold over Glenn Greenwald and dragging him out of Rio. And the second possibility is that David Gregory might just not be considering that there are actually people in this country who make less than $200,000 a year. In David Gregory's world, that's probably really poor.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
David Gregory's like, my God, I mean, even people who are making $200,000 might get hit by this. That's pretty brutal. So David Gregory proving once again why he should be hosting Inside Edition, although I don't know if I would trust him to cover Cameron Diaz's weight loss regimen. Excuse me, no offense to Cameron Diaz. That's just the first person that came to mind. Screw you, David Gregory. You suck.
Oh, man.
And that's a wrap on David Gregory.
That was masterful, Michael. I have to give you props for that one.
He's just like, and he's so smug. I think that's what it is. I mean, like even like Andrew Ross Sorkin said something insane about Greenwald too, and promptly went out, and Sam did this, and it was disingenuous, but he apologized. But Gregory's just like, no, I'm just asking questions. A lot of people have in mind whether or not Greenwald should go to jail. The only people have that in mind are Peter King. Like, no one even from, you know, Dianne Feinstein hasn't even thrown that out there.
There's a large contingent of people online who are constantly knocking Glenn Greenwald left and right. Like,
oh, yeah. People hate Glenn Greenwald.
And they also continually knock him because of his source, Edward Snowden, for the whole NSA story.
Right.
But even those people I haven't seen, for the most part, call for Glenn Greenwald to be prosecuted and put in jail.
I mean, that's just such a mind-blowing step. Anyways, and you know what? In some ways, it would be even – I would be less annoyed if Gregory actually just – you know, it's this whole, like, I'm just posing questions, man. It's like such not – you choose to pose – you know, it's complete nonsense. All right.
What else we got over there?
All right, moving much quickly along here.
So we all know that the economy has been steadily adding jobs. And that's, you know, not enough jobs, obviously. The unemployment rate is still stands at 7.5%. But we all know that when we dig deeper into these numbers and we talk about quality of jobs and we talk about range of opportunities and we talk about who's working, why they're working and where they're working and what they're getting paid, we know that the story is even worse than the not-so-good number to begin with. And basically, this is a report in Think Progress. In June, of the 195,000 jobs added to the economy, the bulk of those were concentrated in what we all call the service sector, which essentially means incredibly low-paid, brutal jobs at places like fast food chains, Walmart, and other temporary and undocumented and, you know, various other places where people are not making enough money to make a living. And of course, this is the whole context for the growth in things like food stamps, right? Because you have people who are not only not able to find work, you have a lot of people who do have work who still need some types of government programs just to survive and just to pay off their bills and just to pay off their credit. I don't think that there's a huge amount to add to this. I just think it's really vital, you know, particularly if you want to defend Obama's record economically, which I actually think is important because whether we like it or not, the debate in the broad public stage has been between Republicans calling for a complete mass austerity, which of course would have completely destroyed the U.S. economy, just as Europe has completely self-detonated and destroyed itself through austerity. And then President Obama, who did push a stimulus and did at least have some understanding and does have an understanding of the need for some public investment and some renewal of opportunity. It's been completely insufficient, I have no doubt. And this is a message, again, more to Obama's defenders. We can debate these job numbers and we can call out Republicans for being completely wrong in their calls for austerity and saying that Obama's stimulus and all this didn't work because it was wrong and it's ludicrous and it's nonsense. But let's not overlook the fact that fundamentally not enough good jobs are being created and way too many people are at the economic margins, and that's because of structural variables that we all know, collapse of labor, massive wealth inequality, shrinking opportunity, and the turning over of those things from opportunity and investment into private debt. So these numbers, when you dig into them, just reaffirm that again and again and again, and we need to be serious about that and look beyond the numbers a little bit. Let's see. I feel like I'm running like a news marathon.
What else you got?
All right. I'll do one more really quick. So Elliot Spitzer is running. He's back. Elliot Spitzer has announced that he's going to run for the comptroller, right, of New York City.
Yes.
Do you know what that job does? What is the comptroller?
I do know that when I graduated grade school, I went to a K through 8 school.
Right.
So when I graduated 8th grade, I received an award from whoever was the comptroller at that time.
Huh.
I still, to this day, have no idea what a comptroller does, but...
You do cite it a lot. Matt will come in the office and be like, hey, I'm the one who was praised by the comptroller over here. All right? I got Public Shame Blog blowing up. I got the comptroller liking my work. No, I'm just kidding. He doesn't do that. I don't really know very much what the comptroller job does either, and I think it's interesting because this was actually the first job that Anthony Weiner had been rumored to be looking at before he broke for mayor. So Spitzer went for this job instead. I have to say, if I had to do a trade-off, I mean, I'm softening to Anthony Weiner a little bit, but I wish Elliot Spitzer was running for mayor. The only other thing that's interesting is that comptroller – oh, you got information on comptroller?
The comptroller is responsible for auditing the performance and finances of city agencies, making recommendations regarding proposed contracts, issuing reports on the state of the city economy, marketing and selling municipal bonds, managing city debt, and serving as managing trustee of the public employees' pension funds.
So Spitzer could be great at this job.
Yes.
So this is amazing. And actually,
I mean, I knew it was something he would be. It's
something
in his
he would
house.
Be good at.
I just wasn't sure exactly what a comptroller did.
Me neither. But this is what Spitzer said, and this is totally in line with Matt's description of that job. This is what he told the New York Times after he announced. Quote, The metaphor is what I did with the Attorney General's office. It, which is the state, the comptroller job, is ripe for greater and a more exciting use of the officer's jurisdiction. I think that's great. I think that means that Elliot Spitzer is going to put pension funds on the block and use the really massive public wealth of New York City to call Wall Street and call the financial sector to account. So that could be excellent. He's only got a couple of days. He needs to get
It's 3,000
signatures. 3,000 signatures by Thursday in order to get on the ballot.
He'll have no problem.
He'll have no problem getting that. I mean, there's one candidate, Stringer, who's the Manhattan Borough President, who's the front runner now. But I think it's pretty hard to imagine that Spitzer doesn't win, and I'm pretty excited about that. I mean, Elliot Spitzer, when he was governor, even before the prostitution stuff, that was a different, that was a more bumpy road for him. But I mean, what he did as Attorney General was, it was great then. And look at, he's just been validated every day. You know, back in 2005, people were like, Anthony, Elliot Spitzer's being a little aggressive on Wall Street. It's a little out of control. I wish every single Attorney General in the United States was out of control like Elliot Spitzer.
Yes.
And let's get him into the comptroller's office and get him out of control on Wall Street again.
Yes.
I can't wait.
And the dumb thing is you hear people talking about, saying, oh, this is going to be a great in terms of, Anthony Weiner running and Elliot Spitzer running. And look at them. They're both ridiculous freak shows. First of all, what both of them did, I think, was blown way out of proportion, period. But on top of that, what Elliot Spitzer did was something between two consenting adults. And I think it's not even in the same world.
And what Anthony Weiner did was over Twitter.
Yes. But still, though, it's not even in the same world as what Anthony Weiner did, regardless of both being no big deal at all.
Well, what's interesting in some ways is like, and I agree with you, neither of those things are big deals. But, if Elliot Spitzer's thing is a bigger deal, his accomplishments are also a bigger deal. So, one hand taketh and the one hand – like, Elliot Spitzer has an amazing public record. Like, again, I keep saying Wall Street alone. He did other stuff when he was Attorney General. He did stuff on the environment. He did stuff on wage protection. He did stuff – he's done a lot of very good things. And maybe Anthony Weiner – he certainly has some good progressive politics. He did some good stuff. He's a good performer. Maybe, he could evolve into that job too. But at any rate, I'm really excited about Spitzer. I think that's cool.
Yes.
I'm glad to see Spitzer back in
politics.
And
from there, maybe we can get Mayor Elliot Spitzer.
Well, I think that's like the perfect launching pad.
I think so too, and I hope that happens. I mean, John Liu is running, and he's much smaller than Elliot Spitzer.
Absolutely. Well,
John Liu is the current comptroller.
Oh, right. Anyways, so that's cool. So final story here before we go into the better half. So as we all know, there was a coup over the weekend in Egypt. The context of that coup is complicated. I mean, there's no question that Morsi was failing.
We'll go into this in the better half.
Oh, go into this in the better half?
Yeah, why should you just wrap it? This is a big deal. You should do a big
deal. Awesome. We'll wrap this up and we'll go right into the better half.
If you want to hear about Michael, who's without a doubt the foreign policy expert here, talk about this, then you're going to need to join the show. And you can do that by becoming a member today at majority.fm. You just click become a member, insert your information. PayPal is our chosen method of payment simply because it is the only method of payment that we could find really that works for everybody. However, if you have a problem with paying via PayPal, we can work something out and you could send us a check. Just contact us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. You can support the show also by clicking on the Amazon link on our front page and doing all your Amazon shopping through that link. You will notice no difference. The prices will not change whatsoever. You will still receive whatever deal you would get from Amazon.com without that link. But Amazon gives us a little bit of a kickback. So with that, you support this show and you don't spend an extra dime. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/majorityreport. Follow us on Twitter at MajorityFM. You can subscribe to us on YouTube, youtube.com/SamCedar. You can also watch us live on YouTube, youtube.com/majorityreportlive. Am I forgetting anything? Oh.
Fair trade
coffee at justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code majority and you get a discount. We get a little kickback from that as well. And you support the show again without having to give us an extra dime. You actually save money on coffee.
And everybody knows that you need this kind of media. Like, you need what Sam does every day. You need to hear from people like Steve Horn. You need it. It's not up for debate. In the better half, tons of amazing stories from Matt. I'll do a quick wrap-up of Egypt. We'll get to your IMs. We'll take your calls. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Libertarians, explain to us why President Obama should be making his decision on the Keystone Pipeline based off of recommendations of a private lobbying firm. I would love to hear you explain that one. I'm sure that you will say something that makes sense fully to you in – oh, if I could find this, it would be so great.
What are you looking for?
No. I was looking for Only in Your Imagination, but it's all right, folks.
Oh, it's Wonka.
Oh, it's Wonka? Oh, that's Willy Wonka's song. You know what? Forget it.
We'll do it in the better half. All right. You can IM to the show. We'll turn the IM machine on. You know all of our legacy IM names.
This is the song. This is the clip for libertarians to call. This is like the Batman signal.
You can also call into the show, 646-257. What's the rest of it? I'm having a mental block.
646-257-3920.
3920. Michael's got me off there with that.
All right. Let's go into the better half. See you.
Sam's back tomorrow.